A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
The Rugby World Cup from The Times. With Mark Suster.
We'll be with you every week with the latest from the tournament, looking at the prospects for the home nations and the other big guns, of course, and reviewing all the action on and off the field.
Find it at thetimes.co.uk or in iTunes.
Welcome to The Game, the podcast that empowers you to win any football debate you find yourself in, or indeed in which you find yourself. Today I'm joined by Patty Barkley, Tom Dart, and from the J to the A to the M to the E to the S to the D to the U to the C to the K to the E to the R, it's James Ducker. Later on, we'll be discussing the Rooney Rule. But first, let's start at the Britannia. Now, if one more person says, well, it's a difficult place to play, then I'm going to do something very unpleasant. So please, nobody say that. Let's just say that Stoke are a team that have progressed very nicely, and they're good, and they're good at home, like many other teams in the Premier League. I just want to start with Liverpool, and something which I thought was quite extraordinary. Kenny Dalglish's reaction after the game, talking that it's not so much the decisions in this match, which we can talk about, but it was the fact that he said it's happened in every game this season and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm surprised that somebody would come out and say this from what is, after all, a position of strength, since Liverpool are doing better this season than many observers predicted. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves Dalglish. Paddy, what's the psychology behind this? Or is there no psychology? And it's just, honest.
There is psychology. I mean, basically, what he's responding to is people like Kenny have always, thought the world's against them. That's what drives these people. They're completely one-eyed. But what's made him come out and say it is, of course, the polluted environment caused by... because when he talked about other people, he talked about, shall we go down the road taken by other people? He meant one other person, Sir Alex Ferguson. And he's basically making the point, what he's saying, and he probably said it very inelegantly, it makes you understand why Ferguson behaves the way he does, because if you moan about getting decisions against you, you might get one for you. Tony Cascarino said it in the Times this morning. That's the way professionals think. I mean, personally, I think the FA should have done him for this. It was explained in the Times this morning that the FA aren't going to do him because he didn't refer to any referee by name. In my opinion, that makes it worse, because what he was implying in what he said, and we all know why he said it, because he's trying to protect himself against Ferguson, but what he's saying is that all referees are ganging up against Liverpool. And that is what Mourinho more or less said in the last year, when he said all referees were ganging up in favour of Barcelona.
Well, it's pretty much what Mourinho said.
So I think
he turned 20.
The blanket criticism of referees as if they were working in a body is something that I think should be number one on the list of the FA's disciplinary priorities, rather than insisting that a referee must be named by name.
Ducker, we're in virgin territory here, a bit of an unusual position, because we're actually doing a podcast talking about Liverpool with not a single Liverpool fan here, but.
Quite rare on our paper.
Exactly. Imagine that. But I want to ask you: do you see all this menace in Dalglish that Paddy sees?
Look, he's skilled, isn't he? He's so experienced. He's seen pretty much kind of everything in the game. I think it was very kind of cleverly couched. I mean, he was kind of explicitly stating his kind of displeasure, and it was obviously, as Paddy said, such a pointed kind of reference to Ferguson. But I just think it was quite a clever way of doing it. I'd just like to see, you know, all reference to referees after the game's, you know, banned. You know, I think if the FA said anyone who discusses referees in any capacity is given a 10-match touchline ban, there'd be no references at all from managers, and we could just get on, you know, discussing kind of, you know, amongst ourselves. I mean, the problem is the, you know, the whole discussion of that game is now dominated by what Dalglish has come out and said.
Yeah.
So, or, you know, any reference to how kind of Liverpool actually played pretty well, but obviously come away with anything. Stoke did very well yet again. You know, but that just becomes a minor issue in the talking points, what Dalglish has said. And then for the rest of the week, particularly if someone ends up getting, in this case, he's not going to, it doesn't look like, but when, you know, when a manager, you know, gets a charge of improper conduct or whatever, you have an article every single day on it, and it just runs and runs and runs. I mean, in the case of Ferguson last season, I mean, there was just days upon end of Ferguson referee stories, and I just think it becomes pretty tiresome and boring. I think if the punishment for discussing referees was extreme, then you wouldn't get them discussing it. And I just think it'd be better for the game, really. I mean, obviously, it's always going to be a talking point, but maybe it should just be a talking point for the media and fans and that to kind of discuss. And
yeah, well, I mean, discussing the decisions is perfectly healthy. I mean, saying that that, you know, discussing the Carragher-Walters incident in technical terms is perfectly healthy. That's what football's all about.
Let's get that in technical terms.
Yeah.
I thought that, I mean, to be honest, I thought that was a penalty. His arms around Walters. Walters might go down easier.
Yeah.
Carragher gets, he should have known better. Mm. And where I think the referee got it wrong was in the first half. I thought that was a handball in the box. His arm was away from his body. And the last one on Upson, I thought there's not much Upson can do about
no,
that.
No, I thought the Upson one was not handball because it
but
was
he had a
deflection.
Point on the first one, right?
The first one, definitely, yes.
Definitely. Tom, let's turn to the football. On Liverpool, Skrtel at right back and Carroll on the bench. Discuss.
Carroll deserves to be on the bench because he hasn't started well enough, and Count and Suarez is a fairly good partnership, I think. I mean, Carroll came on, didn't he? And I think I'm not sure about all this talk about Carroll's fitness. I mean, he seems fine to me. I saw him play against Exeter a couple of weeks ago, and he played reasonably well. I'm sure in a couple of weeks he will force his way into the team and will have forgotten all about this Capello stoked talk of his excess drinking.
But should he forget about the talk of his excess drinking, or should he maybe remember it and maybe drink less?
Well, we don't really know how much he is drinking, do we? It's for a man who professes to have little interest or no interest in what his players do, and a man who seems to be keeping them at arm's length as a matter of policy, I'd be very surprised if Fabio Capello really did know in depth about Andy Carroll's private life.
Well, I mean, first of all, part of Andy Carroll's private life is public because there have been court cases, as you know. But so if Andy Carroll is fit and Andy Carroll is a £30 million player, shouldn't he get into the side? Shouldn't he start more games than he does?
It's difficult to say with Carroll. It is a funny one. I think Tom's got a good point. I'm not sure that he's, you know, his fitness isn't kind of there. I just don't. I mean, you'd think if you join a club like Liverpool for £35 million, then you're going to be seriously buckling down and doing everything to kind of, you know, ingratiate yourself to your teammates, your supporters, you know, trying to make a big impact there. And all just seems a bit wishy-washy, really, the start he's kind of made. And I think maybe it's a focus thing, maybe more than a fitness. And I think if they can get him kind of in the zone, then it could be a very, very potent weapon for him. And a great foil for Suarez. I mean, I've been very very impressed with Schwartzman. He was absolutely brilliant in the Copa America.
But
I think there was a good fall there. But I just think, I mean, Dalglish knows what he's doing. I think he'll be picking his moment to kind of put him in, and it's very early days. I'd like to, think maybe a few months down the line, if we're still in the situation, Gab, where, he's in and out of the team, he's not making much of an impact, would be a bit more of a concern, but it is very early days.
Paddy?
Yeah, well, I think the two things that need to be said. One, he's not a £35 million player. He's sort of two thirds of Fernando Torres. if you see what I mean.
Right.
That was an inflated sort of market, a market inflated by the ludicrous deal.
I don't dare ask you how much Fernando Torres would be worth right now. So that's not
well. If you take the fee that was paid and take the zero off, I would say that would be what he would.
Which would make Carroll a
£3.5 million player. So I mean, the sums aren't significant. The second thing is that he will play. When Suarez hits the wall, because Suarez, of course, has been, played for most of the summer. Probably only had 2 weeks holiday, I guess, if that, after the Copa America, so in which he played a leading role. So, it is only a matter of weeks before Dalglish has to take the tough decision to take his best player, his catalyst, out of the side and shove in Carroll.
I think I've been on the record in this. I think Tony Pulis' Stoke has evolved. It's added a dimension last season. I could see the plan, what he was trying to do. They were going to beat you many different ways, unlike perhaps what they were doing in the first year in the top flight. Now, however, I looked at this team against Liverpool, and again, he's got four center halves in the four defensive positions. No Kenwyn Jones, who's mobile and can play. He spends £10 million on Peter Crouch. And then this Dalap Whitehead in central midfield. Is he reverting to what it was 3 years ago, or did he think, okay, in this game we'll play this team, and in the next game we'll play the guys who can actually play?
I think what he's doing is basically reinforcing the squad to enhance his plan A rather than developing a plan B and becoming more sophisticated.
But he had developed the plan B last year to some degree, hadn't he?
Not that I've noticed particularly. Well, what you have is a very physical, direct side to rely on two decent wingers who can cross the ball to the tall centre forwards, plus obviously you have the set piece arsenal, whether from throw-ins or free kicks. And the signing of Crouch adds depth up front if he wants to play Crouch, or if Cameron Jones is injured, and he's got Waters there as well. Palacios,
Cameron Jerome.
Cameron Jerome, decent pace, another good option. Palacios will come into central midfield, I'm sure, very shortly for perhaps a Whitehead, and is a slightly better player. But it's kind of going to be more of the same from Stoke, except they're now insulated to a degree against injuries. That said, we should probably acknowledge that Crouch, despite his height, is a better player on the ground than in the air. And he's also a far more sophisticated player than he is given credit for. And because he's so tall, we tend to forget that he's actually reasonably subtle.
I think Tom makes a valid point. I think there is a tendency once a team's been established in the Premier League for a few years to suddenly, start saying, they're evolving, they're not as bad as they were, and all this kind of stuff. And what's wrong with Stoke being Stoke and the kind of way they play? And maybe he's fine tuning kind of the plan A and try to bring a little bit more to kind of the Arsenal. And if he thinks Jones and Crouch are much of a muchness, but if Watt gets injured, he's got a ready-made replacement there, and he can kind of rotate, then good for him. I mean, he's got marathon Europa League campaign to negotiate as well. So maybe he wants similar types, and lots of them.
Moving on to the Stadium of Light, and before we get into the game, let's talk some Asamoah Gyan. And I'd like somebody to correct me if they disagree with me, but this is how I read it. So the news breaks on Saturday, and it's all, greedy, awful Asamoah Gyan walking out, and Steve Bruce comes out and says, only 2 days ago, he shook my hand and told me he was going to stay, blah, blah, blah. Asamoah Gyan goes and signs for Al Ain, which is a team from the Emirates, not a particularly good one. It's a one-year loan deal. So, greedy, bad guy, lies to his manager and disappears to the Middle Eastern cash. Then you discover a few different points, such as the fact that Asamoah Gyan comes out and says, I didn't really have a choice. They accepted the loan deal for me. And then we read in George Culkin's piece today that Sunderland are getting £6 million, and that when you for this one-year loan deal, yeah, and when you factor in their savings on John's wages, or another $2 million, they're basically saving themselves £8 million. Now, I know that football clubs love to spin things, but is my reading of this wrong? Isn't this actually a very good deal for Sunderland?
It does seem like it, Gab. I had exactly the same reaction as you when I read it, because the thing about Gyan was that he came from Rennes, mm-hmm, I think it was, where he'd done very, very well. He just took to the Barclays Premier League like the proverbial duck, and then disappeared. I remember seeing him and Welbeck playing up front against Chelsea about this time last year, and they just took them apart. And you thought, this Gyan's cheap at 13 million, then he just completely disappeared. And I assumed that he'd suffered some terrible injury until I read a week ago that he was perfectly fit. It seems to me that Niall Quinn has done a very, very good deal. Don't forget, when he comes back, they'll have anything over 5 million that they get from him for the next mug will be profit. So yeah, it seems like a good deal for the club. The strange thing is that Steve Bruce didn't appear to have been told about it.
Because was he not told about it, or was he just trying to be clever?
That's what you assume when you see him on television say, we shook hands and now he's gone.
Or was he maybe hoping that nobody would find out that they got this fat loan deal, that nobody would go and talk to Asamoah Gyan, and that, in this insular world that we live in, nobody would bother following up and reporting the other side of the story?
But when Steve Bruce implied, there you are, there's the information, you work it out, in actual fact, it's impossible. I think they should rename their ground the Stadium of Murkiness.
Gab, wasn't there quite a lot of speculation all summer about Gyan as well? I mean, was it really a great shock that he kind of left? I mean, I could maybe understand Bruce a bit more if it kind of, there'd be no inkling at all that he wanted to go, or, that his future was, under question, and it suddenly got lumped on him, 2 days before the transfer window closed. But, there's been a lot of uncertainty around his future for months now, so, it's hardly the greatest shock.
Every transfer, if a player wants to leave, the club must paint him in a bad light. It becomes a matter of a kind of a PR victory, doesn't it? The club trying to protest their innocence and say, we didn't want him to go. It's the player's fault. He's greedy. It's always seems to be the way with significant transfers.
Tom, I think that's an exceptional point. And in this case, painting Asamoah Gyan in a bad light, to me, it just seems absolutely stupid and demented from Sunderland's point of view. Because he's on loan. He's still a Sunderland player. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen in the next 12 months. Mm. If he plays very badly, he's going to come back and you'll be on the hook for him for another 2 years and it'll be difficult to move. Mm. If he plays very well, you may want to keep him. If he plays exceptionally well, of course, then you sell him. Mm. So this just seems to me like it was poorly handled. And this stuff it just all really, really bugs me. And it's, this whole manipulation. I want to throw one other possibility out there too about regarding Asamoah Gyan, which has been reported. It was reported in Ghana this morning. Is Ghana are playing a crucial African Cup of Nations qualifier against Sudan in October. Both teams are level on points. It's away from home. And then, of course, if they qualify, they'll have the African Cup of Nations as well.
Yeah.
The way it was spun to me was that, from John's perspective, He's getting a little bit annoyed up on Weir's side. He's not happy with his buddy Anton Ferdinand going and so on. He's got a chance to go there, make the same money, maybe a little bit more after taxes. He can prepare properly for this big qualifier and have a great African Cup of Nations, which he really cares about, and then come back to the Premier League a year from now. And then would it change your assessment of him if you consider those factors?
So is that directed at me, Gab?
Any one of you.
I think looking a year in the future is optimistic, but when I start reading these figures about he's going to earn five times as much, I think he goes up in my estimation, and I find a lot more sympathy for him, because who wouldn't in his position, if that is the case, move to earn five times as much money and be a bigger fish in a smaller pond, especially when he appears to be not entirely happy at Sunderland and might be facing a year on the bench and perhaps losing motivation. His move becomes perfectly understandable, doesn't it?
Well, speaking of strikers who maybe aren't entirely unhappy or entirely productive, let's move on to Chelsea and the striker who was dropped, Fernando Torres. Now, I think we all assumed it would happen at some point. Paddy, am I the only one who was surprised that it happened so quickly?
What, the Torres was dropped?
Yeah.
No, I don't think you are. I mean, it's what people tend to forget about Fernando Torres is that he didn't just sort of have a bit of a bad spell with Liverpool. He's been a fairly marginal figure with Spain. He was, even during the World Cup, he wasn't himself with Spain. I've watched a few of those games.
In fact, if I can jump in there, Paddy, and Ollie Kay writes in today's game, he actually breaks it down, and it's really, he puts the moment in as October 2009 when he suffered a groin injury with Spain. From that moment onwards, his numbers have gone worse. So
yeah,
we're talking nearly 2 years now.
Yes, and it's begun to infect his general play. Once strikers think that their sole job is to improve their figures, they become a liability to the team. I mean, there are other examples of this. Michael Owen is the one that comes immediately to mind. But the Torres situation is very, very serious, because I mean, he faces the possibility that he's going to be remembered as the worst buy of all time. And
ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
And I mean,
Kaká might have something to say about that, but yeah.
Well, I don't think it's pretty hard to disagree with that. I mean, £50 million, you know, for what he's produced is, I think, I don't see how you can even begin an argument.
At this stage of his Chelsea career, Shevchenko had scored six times as many goals as Torres.
Correct. And Shevchenko was older. Torres was bought in his peak in terms of age. So this is much more perturbing than Shevchenko. Everybody realized that, you know, for a player who plays once a pace man loses his legs, then of course he's not going to score as many as he did in Serie A. Now, Sturridge, may I just say something about Sturridge?
Yes.
Because we'll move on to Sturridge, who came in, took what Torres would consider his shirt, and did extremely well. Sturridge, did he score? I haven't seen any evidence that Sturridge did anything other on Saturday than hit the post.
Aha, there's a bit of a conundrum there.
I mean, it was a lovely goal, but if you're going to be, if you're going to win goal of the season for an admittedly artful back heel.
You're saying the ball didn't cross the line?
I don't see, I can't understand, I could not understand why. I've watched it many times on TV, and I can't understand why nobody's taken the trouble to work out if that was a goal or an own goal.
Chucker, should Wes Brown have noticed whether the ball crossed the line or not?
I don't know. I'm not paying enough attention to that, actually, Paddy. You completely throw me there. I watched the back heel, thought it was kind of great.
It was brilliant.
I didn't really pay much attention after showing how good a reporter I am.
But it's almost as if sometimes we say, come on, that's worth a goal, and the defender gets away. I mean, again, totally blameless own goal. Wes Brown did exactly the right thing. Anyway, it's just a little aside that I would chuck in. But he did play well, Sturridge, and you couldn't possibly say from what we saw on Saturday that Torres could be preferred to him.
Tucker, where does Sturridge fit into Chelsea, if at all, with their 7, 8, 28 million strikers?
Well, I mean, it's quite simple, isn't it? If he given a go and plays well and scores goals, and he doesn't the fees for the other strikers start to become ever less important. Villas Boas is just going to he's a new manager starting at a club where the pressure is extreme, and he's going to want his strikers to score goals, and if that means, you know, dropping a £50 million player because one who they signed for, £10 million compensation, you know, he'll happily kind of do that. I suppose there's the English factor and things as well. I mean, he won't obviously be too concerned about that at the moment, but it certainly adds to that kind of English backbone that they've long had. I just think, you know, he's gonna look at it and think if he's scoring goals, you know, I'll pick him on form, just as, you know, say Fergie's been doing at United with his kids.
Yeah, exactly. Fergie doesn't have eight
at all on the worst buy of all time. I mean, you know, as Oliver Kerr writes this morning, you know, the signs haven't been good for quite a while now, but, you know, he is 27. It's not like he's 30. You know, I mean, if at the end of the season, you know, he's only scored a handful of goals, then Chelsea will be very, very concerned. But we are only at the start of September.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I'm saying that unless there is a radical improvement in his general play, never mind goals. I mean, I don't think goals are, even for strikers, I don't think you can just, you can judge players, football player statistically. But I think that his general play is so abysmal, so selfish, that, you know, I understand why successive managers have not played him, because it's like playing with 10 men.
Well, I think that the main concern this season is if Villas-Boas keeps winning and doesn't, that's the only way he can get away with not playing Torres, if he keeps winning. Otherwise, I think this problem's going to come to a head. Mm-hmm. But Tom, I want to finish up with you. Real Madrid and Juan Mata made their first starts for Chelsea. They add a slightly different dimension, both of them, each in his own way, that maybe wasn't there. Do you think they're going to have more of an impact domestically or in the Champions League?
Difficult to say. I can't see Chelsea beating Real Madrid, Barcelona, Manchester United, maybe not Manchester City. Eventually in the Champions League, they would have to come up against one of those clubs. I think it could be realistic they could finish second or third in the Premier League, but I think first would be beyond them. At least now they're adding a bit of freshness with Morelos and Mata, a bit more pace. Sturridge in the team adds a bit of pace and energy and youthfulness. So I think we are witnessing a slow transformation of Chelsea. The trouble is that it's kind of starting to happen from August onwards, when it didn't, not enough of it happened in the summer, when things seemed to go on pretty much as before. So the Villas-Boas project is is going to be underway in during the season, rather than having a proper clear out in the pre-season and really having a transformation. We've still got Josh McEachran to come in as well, who could make an impact perhaps in the second half of the season. Yeah, the squad certainly looking deeper. David Luiz, back from injury now, was on the bench on Saturday, so there are some positive signs that Chelsea are going in the right direction, but I'm not sure it's extensive enough or fast enough in terms of the progress to really make them a force either in the Champions League or in the Premier League in terms of winning the competitions this season.
I'm not sure anybody's sure on that point. This week in our debate, we're going to look at the so-called Rooney Rule. Now, this is a rule that comes from the National Football League in 2003. It was voluntarily accepted by the 32 teams. And basically, what it states is that if you have a head coaching position or senior coaching position open, you have to interview a minority candidate. You don't have to hire him. It's not a quota system. But you have to at least grant a minority candidate an interview. And there's something called a ready list, which is something that the Players Association, you know, submits to saying, we feel that these people are interview worthy. Now, the reason it's relevant is because the lawyer who negotiated this rule with the NFL back in 2003, he's over here. He's been hanging with the guys from the PFA. And, you know, there are steps underway to at least make this part of the conversation here to see if it gets introduced here in England as well. Certainly in the NFL, where about 70% of the players come from ethnic minorities, they went from 6% minority coaches up to 22%. In England, we have a situation where ethnic minorities make up anywhere between 25 and 30% of professionals, but only 2% of coaches. So I want to start with you, Ducker. Is this an obvious no-brainer that would benefit football?
I think the beauty of the rule is that obviously, you know, a chairman, a chief exec or a club, you know, has to interview, you know, minority kind of coach, but doesn't necessarily have to appoint them. So it's not like they are being forced into having to appoint someone who might be kind of inferior to, say, you know, a white coach or whatever. I think that is what's great about the rule, and in that sense, I just think it would be a bit of a no-brainer to introduce. I mean, my kind of point would always kind of go back to, you know, it should be the best man for the job. And if you actually look at some of the white coaches in operation in this country, you know, there's quite a few out there who a lot of people would say aren't up to the job. So, but equally, you know, just giving kind of jobs for job's sake to someone because of their, you know, ethnic background, I think would be kind of wrong. But, you know, it's clear there are barriers.
But that's not what the rule says.
I remember speaking to Andy Cole at length about this, and he just said, I would just love an opportunity to actually get into the door, to actually, you know, speak face to face with some of these chairmen, some of these kind of people.
Well, sorry if I jump in there on Andy Cole, because he's the guy who's most often mentioned, and I mean, you spent time with him, you know him. I'm curious, has he applied for any jobs?
Last time I spoke to him about it was after a debate he'd done about 18 months ago, and he was in the process, I've not spoken to him for a long time about it, but he was in the process of going through his kind of badges. And the last time I kind of spoke to him about it, he was wavering, I think, about whether to actually kind of go ahead with it, because he just felt there were so many barriers to doing his badges that he wasn't sure.
So he's just typical Andy Cole. Maybe
he made the decision now because he's obviously he's quite prominent in the media, so maybe he's gone down that route.
I mean, if I was a chairman, I mean, the thing I'd be swayed by with Andy Cole is he's got a reputation as a prat. Not nothing to do with his colour. It's absolutely nothing to do with that. If you know, if black people can't get jobs, how do you explain Paul Ince?
You're honing in on one individual. I was just kind of using him as an example to kind of just illustrate a point that, you know, if say what Cole is saying is true, that, you know, there are barriers just to actually getting in front of a chairman, actually, you know, speaking to him and telling him what you propose. I just think that if a rule is introduced which allows that, great, and the choice is obviously still with the kind of chairman or chief executive, you know, brilliant. I mean, if clubs...
James, this is... Sorry, I'm sorry, James. Team, James, sorry. This is the key, though, isn't it, right? I mean, I think we need to take a step back here. First of all, I think... I don't know how many clubs actually have formal interview processes where, you know, you go and you bring in 10 candidates and you pick the one you like best. Certainly Aston Villa seemed to do that last year. But secondly, you talk about Andy Cole getting in front of a chairman or an Andy Cole type. And I think this is a key point. I mean, yeah, I'm assuming if Andy Cole wants to go and talk to, you know, the chairman of Arsenal or Tottenham Hotspur, it might be a little bit tricky. But I'm assuming if he wanted to go and start at a League Two club or at a conference club, which is what Paul Ince did, by the way, and he got to the Premier League, and which is the way that, you know, coaches should develop their skills. Surely he wouldn't have a problem. I mean, if he rocked up at Grimsby, do you think Grimsby wouldn't talk to him?
I don't know. Maybe he was talking about the top flight when he was talking about kind of obstacles.
Right. And that's what bothers me, because the thing about Andy Cole, and this applies to everybody, this applies to Roy Keane, this applies to Gareth Southgate, all these people, you know, just because you were a great footballer and you have your coaching badges, you know, this idea that you can just rock up to a top flight club and be entitled to get a job is incorrect. And I think this is where this rule fails. And Tom, I want to get your view on this as well, is the situation in the NFL was quite different in this, and of course nobody's really mentioned this, in the sense that there were a lot of assistant coaches in the NFL who were from minorities, and the problem there were a lot of people who were very good, but they never got the head coaching positions, and they were never even interviewed for those jobs. But there was a large pool of viable minority candidates in the NFL. I don't know what the number is as far as assistant coaches or coaches in the lower divisions who are from minority backgrounds. Well, in fact, we know there's only two who are from minority backgrounds in terms of managers. But my fear here, Tom, is that we could create a situation where we implement the Rooney Rule. Everybody pays lip service, says, "Okay, yeah, here, Andy Cole, you know, come and spend an hour with Ivan Gazidis, and then go away, and then we'll go hire whoever we want to hire," while ignoring the real point is that, you know, are minority coaches getting into the jobs? Are they getting assistant jobs? Are they getting jobs in League Two and in the conference, which is where you should start?
That's precisely the point, Gab. If you're going to ask why aren't there more black managers, you first have to ask why aren't there more black coaches, because you can't be a manager unless you are first a coach. And to me...
Unless you're Gareth Southgate.
Unless you're Gareth Southgate. Unless you get fast-tracked. But generally speaking, that's true, and especially now when you really need a pro licence. I'm not sure of the exact figures of how many black coaches there are, but I don't think there are very many. I'm not sure how many... black former players are taking the badges. You need to have that layer of talented coaches who can then hopefully get interviews and get attention for jobs before anything can happen. And the other big change between the NFL and English football is you have relegation in English football, which makes it far more volatile, which means I think a chairman will be much more wary of taking a risk on a relative unknown and promoting someone who's done well in an interview who they didn't previously know. They'd be more careful about that if he was inexperienced, because of the greater risks, whereas in the NFL you can make money even if you're a bad team or a good team. You've probably got more time to impress, and the consequences of failure are a lot less serious. This is a problem for society in general, by the way, the lack of black people in positions of leadership. I look, and it took until 2009 before a leading British company had a black chief executive. ridiculous, really. And apparently there was only in 2009 one black director of a FTSE 100 company. Mm. It's not just football where this is a problem. This is a problem for British society as a whole.
Just to wrap this, I'm just looking through this, just limiting myself to British and Irish managers in top flight. And if you look at this, if you look at where they started their managerial career and what their background was at players. Now, Sir Alex Ferguson, of course, started at East
Stirlingshire.
Exactly. Tony Pulis was basically a second, third division type player. Started lower down. Okay, Dalglish was the king, so we'll move on. Alan Pardew was another maybe marginal top flight player.
Yeah, he played, right? played in the top flight.
But also started his managerial career lower down the food chain.
Yep.
Mick McCarthy was a great player and started at the top. Am I right in thinking, or did he not?
Yeah, well, he had jobs at Celtic and Manchester City. So, right. I mean, yeah. But Mick McCarthy, of course, was a self-made player. He wasn't a talented player like Andy Cole or Kevin Keegan, of course, breaks the mold. Mm. But anyway, carry on.
No, I was just going to say, David Moyes, right?
David Moyes,
average player, worked his way up.
Celtic, no.
Roy Hodgson, awful player, had to go abroad to get a job. Yep. Owen Coyle, basically a lower division player.
Yeah, lower division striker. Yeah,
and worked his way up. Mm-hmm. Harry Redknapp, top flight player, but worked his...
Bournemouth. He found his level at Bournemouth.
But worked his way up the food chain.
Absolutely
right?
did. And studied under one of the greatest England coaches, English coaches, Ron Greenwood.
Neil Warnock
was a useless winger.
Exactly, and worked his way up.
The bottom, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Steve Bruce, great player, gifted as changed many different jobs.
A bit like
Mr. Loyalty.
A bit like most players who become good managers lacked pace.
Right.
If you look at a player who becomes a good manager, almost invariably they lack pace. They have to think.
Brendan Rodgers, not a footballer,
not
of course.
A footballer,
and
no.
Steve Keen, not really a footballer of any
really
kind
a
of significance.
No.
Not really a manager in which note either.
That's not very nice. I'm about to introduce the quick hit segment. Now, we've had some requests that the quick hits is not a nice name. Off the fence, of course, producer Chris, the producer's suggestion is also a horrible name. So if you have better suggestions, please hit us up with them. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Marconti. And, of course, Chris is at producer Chris.
Mm-hmm. And the prize for the best suggestion is...
gets Patty Barkley to take you out to lunch. Let's get rolling. Wayne Rooney gets another hat trick as Manchester United steamroller Bolton. Patty, apart from Cleverley's injuries, any blemishes in United's glorious facade?
No, not at all. I mean, it is quite extraordinary the way that they have reacted to the defeat by Barcelona in the Champions League final. It verges on miraculous. And thank goodness that Tom Cleverley's injury isn't as bad as was feared, and he should be back. It's just a sprained ankle ligament, and he should be back in the reasonably near future.
Kind of a mismatch, isn't it? Arsenal steady the ship a tiny bit in beating Swansea, but the only goal is a dreadful blunder by Michael Vorm. Tom, it's too early to say Arsenal have turned the corner, isn't it?
No, it certainly is. If they get pasted by Borussia Dortmund in the Champions League this week, then be back to square one. They were pretty unconvincing against Swansea, and the goal was completely embarrassing. Arsenal really need Vermaelen, Wilshere and Diaby back before they can start to play close to their maximum, and even then I don't think their maximum will be good enough for anything better than fourth place, and the squad, despite a couple of good additions, isn't good enough.
Gary Cook has resigned his post at Manchester City. Ducker, does this mean he now accepts that his email was not hacked by some mystery mischief maker, the one he disciplined, supposedly? And given that his inane posturings aside, he was actually pretty good at his job. How big a blow is this to the club?
On the email, yes, of course it does, although you wouldn't have known that from the way my copy was watered down on Saturday. Mm. He was behind the scenes. He was an excellent chief executive, even if that's not the popular perception. It would have been a blow if it had come 12 months ago, but they're in the Champions League now. They've got the big sponsorship deal. A lot of the major infrastructure works are well underway or complete. So if he was going to go, it's not that bad a time, and they will appoint someone who is equally adept, I'm sure, and probably less PR gaffe prone, and move on.
Gab, one for you now. Serie A finally kicked off this weekend. I imagine it was the same old dour but defensive Italian organised football, almost as boring as Manchester City, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I can't promise that this will last all season, but there was very little organisation, some bad defending, and lots and lots and lots of goals. Inter Milan blowing a 2-1 lead at Palermo to lose 4-3. AC Milan going 2 goals down against Lazio, battling back to 2-2 draw. Roma, who I'm really excited to watch this season, stinking it up, losing at home to Cagliari. Napoli, of course, winning 3-1 on Saturday night. And Juventus winning 4-1 at Parma in their new stadium. Plenty of entertainment, plenty of excitement. I'm not going to tell you it's going to last all season, but it was really, really good while it lasted. That's all we've got time for this week, but you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, the web chats. Paddy's is on Mondays, mine is on Tuesday. We're also on Twitter, as you know. So basically, you can spend your entire football-loving week with us, but we're going to have to say goodbye. So till next time, peace out.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.